You're listening to the Sunrise Community Church Podcast. At Sunrise, we desire that the glory of God would be the glory of this city. If you would like more information about our church, please visit our website at sunrisecc.com. Let's join this week's message.
We began the book of Genesis with the following words. Genesis is a book of origins. The origin of creation, the origin of mankind, the origin of the institutions by which civilization flourishes, and the origin of the one special family God chose as his own to bless the world through. And transcending all these beginnings and origins is God himself, who has no beginning or origin. Indeed, if we possessed a Bible without the book of Genesis, we would be in a house with no foundation. We would have no proper doctrine of God if there's no Genesis. We'd have no doctrine of creation if there's no Genesis. We would have no beginnings of the covenant if there's no Genesis. No doctrine of man if there's no Genesis. No genealogy in Matthew or Luke if there's no Genesis. And no substantial use of Adam and Abraham in Paul if there's no Genesis. And perhaps most potent, we would have no understanding of a future better than Eden in Revelation if we didn't first see the perfect Eden in Genesis. How like God to write a story that begins perfect and ends better. So here we are today, almost 2 years later, finally coming to the end of this first and wonderful book in the Bible. Personally speaking, two things have stood out to me the most in these 2 years together. I have been encouraged first at how messy and sinful the patriarchs and their families are. We've really seen this crew at their best, and that's been great and inspiring and encouraging, but we've really seen them at their worst, and that's also been great and encouraging, and reminds us that God's people have always been a very sinful and at times appalling people. We've always been in need of rescue and redemption, and even though these individuals lived in a vastly different culture and time than we do, how much in common have we seen that we have with them? That's first. Second, I have been so encouraged and surprised at how powerfully and how frequently the gospel has made itself known in these 50 chapters. From many angles, through various circumstances, and by way of many people, we have beheld the gospel of Jesus Christ pastorally, doctrinally, and robustly more times than I would have imagined in these 50 chapters. Well, as we now come to the end, no surprise, we'll see those two things, the sinfulness of the people here in view and the glory of the gospel. Those two things are really on display as this book wraps up. There's many ways to divvy up this final chunk in Genesis. I've split it into three. So see the first heading, Jacob's death. This is chapter 49, verse 29. So remember, the chapter headings don't always coincide with, I think, the preaching portions. Chapter 49, 29 through 50, 13. Follow along as I read. Then Jacob commanded them and said to them, I am to be gathered to my people. Bury me with my fathers in the cave that is in the field of Ephron the Hittite, in the cave that is in the field at Machpelah to the east of Mamre, in the land of Canaan, which Abraham bought with the field from Ephron the Hittite to possess as a burying place. There they buried Abraham and Sarah, his wife. There they buried Isaac and Rebekah, his wife. And there I buried Leah. The field and the cave that is in it were bought from the Hittites. When Jacob finished commanding his sons, He drew up his feet into the bed and breathed his last and was gathered to his people. Then Joseph fell on his father's face and wept over him and kissed him. And Joseph commanded his servants, the physicians, to embalm his father. So the physicians embalmed Israel. 40 days were required for it, for that is how many are required for embalming. And the Egyptians wept for him 70 days. And when the days of weeping for him were past, Joseph spoke to the household of Pharaoh, saying, "If now I have found favor in your eyes, please speak in the ears of Pharaoh, saying, 'My father made me swear, saying, I am about to die. In my tomb that I hewed out for myself in the land of Canaan, there you shall bury me. Now therefore, let me please go up and bury my father. Then I will return.' And Pharaoh answered, 'Go up and bury your father as he made you swear.' So Joseph went up to bury his father. With him went up all the servants of Pharaoh, the elders of his household, and all the elders of the land of Egypt, as well as all the household of Joseph, his brothers, and his father's household. Only their children, their flocks, and their herds were left in the land of Goshen. And there went up with him both chariots and horsemen. It was a very great company. When they came to the threshing floor of Atad, which is beyond the Jordan, they lamented there with a very great and grievous lamentation, and he made a mourning for his father 7 days. When the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites, saw the mourning on the threshing floor of Atad, they said, 'This is a grievous mourning by the Egyptians.' Therefore the place was named Abel Mizraim. It is beyond the Jordan. Thus his sons did for him as he commanded them, for his sons carried him to the land of Canaan and buried him in the cave of the field at Machpelah to the east of Mamre, which Abraham bought with the field from Ephron the Hittite to possess as a burying place." Well, we come now to something that we have expected for, I think, the past like 10 or so chapters, even though it still saddens us. We come to the death of Jacob. No doubt, Jacob is one of the most important figures in all of Genesis. I mean, think about, we saw a long chunk, chapter 12 to 23, 24 for Abraham. Isaac got like a paragraph in the middle. And then the whole back half of Genesis has to do with Jacob. You think about the importance just in words and space given to this third patriarch ought to tell us something of his prominence. I mean, Abraham received the promise from God that God would make him a great nation. He had two sons that ended up separating, that had nothing to do with each other. Isaac then had two sons, and they didn't get along as well. It's not until Jacob and his 12 sons that this family will come into and turn into a nation. It's not until Jacob, until the promise made to Abraham starts to become a reality. Because in Jacob and in these sons that become the tribes, the family becomes the nation. And yet here we've come to his death. We see it occur at the ending paragraph of chapter 49. Jacob's final request is to be buried in the cave belonging to Abraham. There's so much to see here. It seems like legal speak. Like this is how Jacob came to acquire this piece of property from Ephron the Hittite. Oh, by the way, he acquired it to be a burying place. It won't let us forget this. It's ironic that even though this great promise has been made, this promised land is yours, the only piece this family actually at this time owns is this cave that they're all buried in. It's the only piece they own yet. But there's not only legal speak, there's sentiment here. There's fond affection here. Jacob mentions dear loved ones buried there already. Abraham, Sarah, Isaac, Rebecca, and Leah. Did you notice, though, in the reading of it? Abraham and his wife. Isaac and his wife and Leah. Not wife. But though he doesn't call her a wife, remember she's the unloved spouse, Rachel was the beloved wife, he chooses to be buried and lie in death with Leah, not Rachel. I think he does this to identify not only with Leah, but with the family and with the covenant promises. Then he dies, and the promise that God made to Jacob in chapter 46 comes to pass, that Joseph would be the one to close his eyes in death. And then chapter 50 begins. In verse 1 to 3, we see Joseph react, I think, as a son ought to react at the death of his father. He falls over him. He weeps. He kisses him. This is a great display of affection. It tugs at the heartstrings the more you linger at it. And notice Joseph doesn't bury him right away. He has him embalmed, which I think is a synonym for mummification. This is what's going to happen to Joseph at the end of the chapter as well. And a total of 70 days of mourning begin not just in the family, but in the nation of Egypt. Certainly, this was in deference to Joseph for all that he has in his person and his work meant for this nation. But it's remarkable to see that this third patriarch, the son of God, is lamented for in all of Egypt. It's as if, Andrew mentioned during the week, the father of Pharaoh has almost died. That's the importance given to Jacob. In verse 4 to 6, Joseph makes a request of Pharaoh that he'd be able to leave and go bury his father in Canaan. Pharaoh agrees, and thus we see beginning the grandest, largest state-funded funeral in all of the Bible. It begins, well, we have it in verse 7 to 13, with all kinds of pomp and circumstance. I mean, see the great procession that goes out of Egypt. In verse 7, the elite in all of Egypt were there. In verse 8, the whole family of Joseph was there, except the kids and the livestock. They're back at home. And in verse 9, we see the military of Egypt comes, chariots and horses and all. In verse 10, we see something of the direction they took out of Egypt. This might seem a small detail, but many draw attention to this, and so we ought to draw attention to it as well. They arrive at something called the threshing floor of Atad. Now, that this whole company arrived there means that in order to get there, if you look at a map of this pre-Exodus Egypt and region, it means that they would have had to go around the Dead Sea and up the side, the east side of the Jordan River, to arrive at this threshing floor of Atad. You're like, what? Why does that matter? This is the same route that the Israelites would take 400 years after this in the Exodus. That the same route occurs here pre-Exodus leads many to call this moment with the chariots, the horses, the military commanders, Pharaoh himself, all the elite of Egypt, and the Israelites coming out of Egypt. This is almost a dress rehearsal for the Exodus, though under vastly different circumstances. The final details of Jacob's burial are given in verse 11 to 13. Only the sons of Jacob go on from the threshing floor into Canaan to the cave to put Jacob's body in. And the mourning was so loud that all the Canaanites took notice and thought the Egyptians were going crazy, but then they said their goodbyes afterwards and they returned. And as the whole procession went back the way they came, we must note a sobering detail. The tribes that would come from these sons would come to dwell in Canaan, in the Promised Land, once again after the Exodus. But for these sons, as they turned away from Jacob's grave, went back into Egypt, this was the last time that any of them would ever see the promised land again with their own eyes. It would be their descendants who would come back in. Something of a sobering detail that makes us think of Hebrews 11. All these died in faith, having not obtained the promise, but they still looked for it far ahead and grasped it by faith. Well, thus ends the life and times of Jacob, the son of Isaac, the grandson of Abraham. See second now, Joseph and his brothers. This is chapter 50, verse 14 to 21, as the text continues. After he had buried his father, Joseph returned to Egypt with his brothers and all who had gone up with them to bury his father. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, "It may be that Joseph will hate us and pay us back for all the evil that we did to him." So they sent a message to Joseph saying, "Your father gave this command before he died. Say to Joseph, please forgive the transgression of your brothers and their sin because they did evil to you. And now please forgive the transgression of the servants of the God of your father." And Joseph wept when they spoke to him. His brothers also came and fell down before him and said, "Behold, we are your servants." But Joseph said to them, "Do not fear, for am I in the place of God? As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. So do not fear. I will provide for you and for your little ones." Thus he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. Well, I told you we'd see sin in the text, and it didn't take long. Didn't take long after the death of Jacob for the brothers to return to something of their former patterns of fearful, trying to cover up things and connive their own way to get out of trouble. And that's what we see here. They all return from the funeral and the burial, and Joseph's brothers grow anxious and afraid. So what do? In their anxiety and their fear, they conclude that Joseph is probably going to, now that dad's dead, probably going to seek retribution against them. Because, you know, we really know Joseph. We just ignore the past time that he's welcomed us and provided for us. We know our brother. He's going to hate us. He's probably going to kill us and throw us all in a pit and sell us off to another nation like we did to him. On one hand, this is quite understandable. They've truly done wrong and done evil to Joseph in the past, and their consciences are clearly still feeling the weight of their former sins, as we can see here. But while on one hand it's understandable, on the other hand we ought to pity them for their reaction. Their sinful fear has changed their view of reality, has changed how they perceive reality. It's where, again, we need to make the distinction. Reality is reality. Perception, though it matters, is not reality. Reality is reality, not how you perceive it to be. The brothers perceive something to be true. That's not true. But we ought to pity them because their sinful fear has really warped how they view their brother. And Joseph loves them, has shown them so much grace and so much mercy and so much provision and so much care. Yet in this moment, they don't remember any of that. They seem to have quite forgotten all of that. And so see what they do. They lie to Joseph using dad's name and make up this tall tale. Oh, by the way, let's write a letter to Joseph from dad and tell Joseph that Dad wanted him to forgive us for what we did to him. Good plan. And so they do that, using their father's name, even though he's dead now, to try to seek forgiveness from Joseph's, even calling themselves servants of God, to try to wrap it in more pious or godly, devout terms. How's Joseph going to respond to this? He could respond in the way they fear, with retribution, with anger, with wrath, with justice. You did this to me, now I will do this to you. He could have responded like this. Maybe even the brothers think of this plan using Jacob's name like this because they recognize that Joseph holds Jacob so highly that if they say Dad told him to do this, then Jacob's going to obey Dad, even though he's still, he's dead. He's not there any longer. Joseph's still going to do it. But see what Joseph does. He does not execute retribution. He doesn't get angry. He doesn't stir up wrath or anything. Instead, he weeps for them. He weeps for them because I think he pities them that they are so quick to believe the wrong things about him, and they're so slow to remember the right things about him. They're so quick to believe that he will respond in anger, and they're so slow to forget, or so quick to forget, so slow to remember all the provision and the welcome and the kind moments when they were reunited in tears without Jacob in Egypt when he was off back at home. Well, when his brothers finally work up the nerve to come before Joseph in verse 18, Joseph has three reasons for them on why they should not be afraid. First, in verse 19, Joseph says, "Do not fear. For am I in the place of God?" There might be a double meaning to this. He is in a very powerful position, a God-like position over them, being second in command over all of Egypt. He has great power to do what they're afraid of him doing. I don't think that's the main thrust here, though. I think the second thing we ought to see in this first phrase in verse 19 is more a reaffirmation of what he's already told them from chapter 45, verse 8. I'm here in this place because God sent me here. Not you, God sent me here on ahead of you. It was not you who did it. Ultimately, it's him who brought me here. And so, don't be afraid. That's the first thing he says in verse 19. And second, in verse 20, we come to something that is one of the most famous moments in the entire Old Testament. Genesis 50:20, Joseph says, "As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today." This verse is famous for good reason, very famous for very good reason. It's one of the proof texts. It's a good word. It's not a bad word. One of the proof texts explaining God's sovereignty and his providence. And I think let's define this. Providence, rightly defined, is not talking about God knowing things beforehand, but talking about how God works in upholding, sustaining, guiding, providing for, and governing all things. That's the work of providence. In his providence, we see God's control and care over all things. There is not a rogue molecule in the universe, because God providentially governs everything and so orchestrates all according to his own sovereign pleasure. But more than just providence is in view here. we can kind of, you know, if you're going to like peer into providence, you can see something else in view here, the doctrine of concurrence. Has anyone heard of the doctrine of concurrence before? It's a subcategory of providence, like, you know, providence heading and like drop down. Concurrence is one of the categories that falls underneath the umbrella of providence. Concurrence speaks of how God can bring his sovereign will to pass, not apart from the choices and actions of all humans, but through the choices and actions of all humans, regardless of them being good or bad. So there seem to be two streams from our point of view, God's will and the will of man. Well, the doctrine of concurrence is there to explain theologically how there's really only one stream. There's not two. In God's sovereign control and providential ruling over all things, there is one stream. This is hard to grasp, but this is exactly what Joseph is telling his brothers here, that though they were doing evil, true evil to Joseph, God was doing something good in their evil far greater than the brothers knew. What good? Keeping many people alive during the famine. That's the good in view here in context. Perhaps we can say it differently, though. The brothers truly meant evil to Joseph, but in their evil actions, God was at work, such that the brothers, in their wickedness, only proved to be instruments in God's hands, bringing about things far more wonderful than they ever could imagine. So they thought they're doing one thing, and yet it just turns out that that one thing they were doing turns out to be the thing that God wanted to happen to bring about his design and his purpose and pleasure in it all. All of that together makes this the Romans 8:28 of the Old Testament. That's what we see. We have Romans 8:28 in the Old Testament that all things, God works and causes all things for the good of those who believe, those who are called according to his purpose. You meant evil, God meant it for good. Both were active in the same events to bring about good, just as God works for good here. I would even say we would not have Romans 8:28 if we didn't have Genesis 50:20 first. This is something of the foundation we stand on in order to arrive at Romans 8:28 far down the road. This gives us such a great hope. It's like the lyrics we just sang in Sovereign Over Us. It's this scripture, these two scriptures molded together and then put to melody is what we sang. Here we learn not only that nothing happens to us in life that doesn't ultimately come from the hand of God, but we also learn that in all that God allows to come into our lives, in it, he has no wicked purposes for his children. Everything works to the good. Everything. Is there anything not included in everything? No! Everything is included in everything. And that's the joy that we have here. So we have good reason to not despair in good times, in bad times, or any times that we have at all. That's the second thing Joseph tells his brothers to not fear. Third, in verse 21, Joseph tells his brothers, so, because of these first two things, do not fear. I will provide for you and your little ones. Not only does he remind them in verse 19 that he's in God's place, not only does he remind them in verse 20 of God's providence, but here in verse 21, he reminds them of God's provision. Place, providence, provision, all ought to lead in these brothers to not fear and to rest in the enjoyment and the provision and the abundance of Joseph. That's what they ought to do. These are great words of comfort to Joseph's anxious and fearful brothers. And how can we from there not also say, are any of you anxious or fearful? Like, fill in the blank. What are you worried about? Let this verse ease you. Let it console you and comfort you. God intends to do that in it. He gave us this verse so that we would not fear, but trust and enjoy Him. In the midst of our lack, in the midst of our worry, in the midst of our concern, God has graciously and kindly provided verses like verse 20 to ease us and to lighten the load. Well, understanding that nothing can overburden Him. You can lean into this, or you can let the weight of your anxieties plague you. You have a choice in this. I often say in counseling and discipleship or over coffee, if somebody is really, really burdened, you know, there is really good time in life to pick up a bunch of weight and just put it on you. Like if you're doing squats, that's a great time to do that. You pick up a bunch of weight and just put it on you, and it's good for you. It's good for your back. It's good for your legs. It's good for all of you. You're doing that with all your worries, and it's not good for you. You have to make the choice to pick up that weight and carry it. And so sometimes my counsel is make a different choice. Choose to trust God instead of staring at your worries. This passage takes us there again and again and again. It needs to be embedded in our brains and our minds, on the back of our eyelids, so that we see it and live in light of it all our days. Well, third and finally, we see Joseph's death at the end in verse 22 to 26. So Joseph remained in Egypt, he and his father's house. Joseph lived 110 years, and Joseph saw Ephraim's children of the third generation. The children also of Machir, the son of Manasseh, were counted as Joseph's own. And Joseph said to his brothers, I am about to die, but God will visit you and bring you up out of this land to the land that he swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. Then Joseph made the sons of Israel swear, saying, God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones from here. So Joseph died, being 110 years old. They embalmed him, and he was put in a coffin in Egypt. Well, here the book of Genesis now comes to an end with the death of Joseph. It mentions that he and his brothers and all their families lived out the remainder of their lives in Egypt. And Joseph lived to be 110 years old, long enough to see multiple generations of his family come. How encouraging is that? It's actually an important note. Historians will say of ancient Egypt that there was a common belief in Egyptian culture that if you died at 110, you've lived the perfect life. This was just part of Egyptian culture. 110 is the goal. You don't want to go longer. You don't want to go shorter. You want to die at 110. And here Joseph, it just so happens, perhaps this might be a witness of something of Egypt to pay attention to Joseph's life more, but he dies at 110 years old. And ironically, this is also the same age that Joshua, later on, who will take the people into the promised land, he will live to 110 years old as well. Joseph's last words are prophetic. While he does make a request known, just like Dad, that his bones would be carried up, be taken into the promised land, he says something that is stunning to see in verse 24. I am about to die, but God will visit you and bring you up out of this land to the land that he swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. Well, when did God visit this family, this nation, to bring them up out of the land and back into the promised land? The Exodus. How curious that the book of Genesis ends in hope, a hopeful prophetic statement that the Exodus will not only occur, but that the promise made to Abraham will be kept. And Genesis is over. Just like that. The first book of Bible, the first book of the Bible is done. And we have traveled, church, for 2 years from Eden to Egypt. Let's look at that pattern as we bring this moment to conclusion. The grand pattern of Genesis. What a journey this has been. God's people, just two of them, Adam and Eve, God's people began safe in Eden. And God's people ended, the big family that it was, safe in Egypt. What happened in between? Nothing, it seems, but a bunch of sin and mess and absolutely crazy, appalling wickedness. Yet despite all that, they're safe and secure in Egypt. And God's doing preparatory work to get the Exodus ready. I mean, it takes 400 years, but God will bring these people out in his own good time. The lesson we ought to learn from this, safe, mess, safe. God's covenant promises are always secure. So God's people are always secure, even in the midst of that mess in the middle. And that's the lesson of Genesis of the millions for us today. We were created in the image of God, Genesis 1. We were brought into this world as fallen sinners, Genesis 3. We will one day be safe in the greater promised land to come. But here we are in the in-between, in the waiting room. Our lives can truly be crazy at times. Very sinful at times. And all the sin that we bring with us, and all the sin of others that comes to us, both directions, we are contributors and we are contributed upon sin, it changes us. It impacts us. It takes its toll on us. But rather than leaving us despairing, it ought to give us a greater hope for the promised land to come. I mean, Hebrews 11 is chock full of statements about Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Joseph even, that these all died in faith, not obtaining the promises that were made to them, but they welcomed them at a distance. As it was for them, because of the gospel, so it is with us. In the middle of this crazy time that we find ourselves, not just around us, but in us too, we can not despair and rest because his covenant is sure and secure. And because his covenant with us is sure and secure, we are sure and secure forever. You never have to feel lost if you're His, because you're not, even if you perceive that to be. Your perception might not be reality. His reality ought to define our own. May it do so more and more.
Thank you for listening to the Sunrise Community Church Podcast. We pray you are blessed by the preaching of God's Word. If you would like more information about our church, please visit our website at sunrisecc.com. May the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, the love of God, and the fellowship of the Holy Spirit be with you all.